Okay. I'm also pleased to give this talk here in the workshop, which I think is very useful for me anyhow in listening to all of the different viewpoints on singularities. So when Gary asked me to give a talk, we agreed that it would be best to talk about this work, which is somewhat old, but it's the closest I've been to a space-time singularity. So it's better to work-wise. So that's better anyhow to talk about this. So it's work that I did together with Ben Krops and Sateep Sethi about, well, what is it, 1.5 years ago. So space-time singularities, well, they occur in classical solutions of Einstein gravity. And of course, we are interested to know what happens when you have a theory of quantum gravity and what it will do to it. They occur inside black holes and in cosmology. And the kind of example that I will look at is not in one of those cases. It's sort of more a toy example. But we're going to learn something, I hope. Anyhow, the hope in string theory, or any quantum theory of gravity, is that these singularities are resolved. But what does this actually mean? I think here I summarize what I think most physicists will believe, namely that the space-time notion becomes ill-defined due to whatever quantum effect or gravitational effects, and that in terms of a fundamental degrees of freedom, there must be a well-defined quantum evolution still appearing there. So I hope that, well, anyhow, the model that I will be describing will indeed have some of those features. There are other things we learned about singularities in string theory. There have been some singularities that are quite well understood, like orbifolds and conifolds. Orbifolds is where you have a space-time modded out by some discrete group, or conifolds where certain cycles will shrink. And there you learn sort of that there are certain light degrees of freedom that have been integrated out, and that sort of generates the singularity. And to get a non-singular description, you usually have to add those light degrees of freedom in. And again, this is sort of a similar thing that will happen in the thing I'll describe today. For me, less well understood, but they have been studied in perturbative string theory, are the Minkowski, or sort of time-dependent orbifolds, where you take Minkowski space and model it out by some Lorentz transformation. And some familiar examples are, and I'll just mention them, Milner space. This is where you identify Minkowski space with a boost, and you get a space sort of that looks like that. Or another type of singularity that has been studied is the no orbifold. Is there you have some kind of different kind of Lorentz transformation, which has again a fixed set, which is a null-like sheet, a light sheet in space-time. I mention these because also, well, we'll see actually the Milner space appearing in my work as well, but also the generalizations of the work that we'll be describing also involve generalizations of this null orbifold situation. So what I'll do is describe this Big Bang model sort of being a null singularity in M theory, and describe what it looks like in string theory as a light-like linear dilaton. And then I'll go to the matrix theory description in terms of a one-dimensional Super-Yang-Mills theory. Yesterday I was also asked to sort of explain for the general audience here what matrix theory is, and I will indeed do this, but I will postpone this to sort of the end, because most of what I'll describe certainly in the beginning will not depend on any knowledge of what matrix theory is. So the picture that's going to arise is indeed sort of a controllable description near the singularity, where we start, if you look at the time evolution in this case will be light cone time. And near the singularity, indeed space-time will lose its meaning, and you get something that looks like matrices. That's where the name comes from. But as soon as you go away, the matrices start to commute, and you get a picture in terms of weakly coupled strings. And so space-time will indeed emerge out of some matrix description. So what is the singularity I'm looking at? Here I wrote it down in M-theory coordinates. Actually, there are various ways to write it down. This is an M-theory coordinates which I use are light cone coordinates, so that the whole dependence of the space-time is only in the x plus coordinate. So Q is some arbitrary parameter. Actually, it doesn't really make a difference what it is, because you can always rescale x plus and x minus in such a way that you can put Q to any value. Indeed, you can also redefine other light cone coordinates, U and V, and then the metric looks like this. And this is indeed a singularity, a singular space, because there is, if you compute the components of the Riemann tensor, you find that some of them will blow up at U equals zero. So you indeed should conclude that the space, when you take only the space U larger than zero, is geodesically incomplete. And also, well, you can check, of course, that the Einstein equations are satisfied. So it's a solution of pure 11-dimensional Einstein theory. Of course, it's also an M-theory solution. And what I will do is now go to the string theory description. And the 11th direction will be identified with the y coordinate, so I'm actually going to compactify the y direction, and so reduce, and then this will play the role of the dilaton coupling, because the periodicity of the 11th coordinate is related to the string coupling, and precisely the powers that appear here will tell me that indeed the string coupling will be a linear dilaton, described by a linear dilaton background.
Some unboosted version of this that makes sense? Often you can play with metrics by infinitely boosting something.
Well, I don't know actually, because in describing this background, it's quite essential that the dependence is in the light cone direction. Certainly, if we start from the linear dilaton background, because only in that case a linear dilaton is a solution to the 10-dimensional. Equation. So we started from the 10-dimensional solution where there was actually the one that I'm going to show right now, which is much simpler. Namely, there you have just flat space and you have a linear dilaton which is in this direction. So you might want to get this from some other dilaton profile, but you have to worry about the fact that the central charge is no longer the same. Because indeed, so why is a light like the linear dilaton a solution? Well, linear dilaton backgrounds have been considered quite often, namely for non-critical strings. But in the case when we are in 10 dimensions, we can also write it down, but then you choose to have a light-like direction. And of course, it means that the string coupling will go to infinity at a certain coordinate value x going to minus infinity. We put it at minus infinity to think about this, namely as sort of we start from strong coupling and then we go to weak coupling in the future. This metric, this solution is a half VPS solution. This is nice because then you can, rely on supersymmetry. And indeed, you can check that it satisfies Einstein's equation with the dilaton source. As I mentioned, I mean, if the central charge, this linear dilaton introduces a central charge on the world sheet, but it only couples to the x plus coordinate. So if you would covariantly quantize the world sheet coordinate, you'd add this term to the stress energy tensor, but the central charge doesn't change because, Q is in the light-like direction. So even the world sheet description is very simple, and what we're going to do eventually is actually go to a light cone gauge also for the world sheet string theory to make things even more simple. What kind of instability? I mean, you asking about tachyons or? As far as I mean, the spectrum can be analyzed quite directly, and it's related to just the usual free string spectrum, so the quantization is quite easy. I don't see any. Oh, that's a good question. I don't know. I mean, this is something I haven't thought about.
Does the singularity, the linear distance is straightforward and finite.
That's correct, because that's precisely what's happening here. If I go to the Einstein frame, then we have to rescale the metric by an appropriate power. And of course, if you see this, you immediately think about choosing new coordinates. And if you do it like this, you find that the 10-dimensional Einstein metric looks like this. And then the singularity, is at u equals 0. And so the Dilaton profile is now the logarithm of the coordinate. And you find indeed at u equals 0, again, there's a null singularity, and you can check that also the Riemann tensor has again a singular. So even the Einstein frame in 10 dimensions is a singular geometry, and the Einstein equations are again satisfied. So in this case, there is a Dilaton source. The Einstein frame metric is indeed what you sort of then see the singularity in. In the string frame, you don't see it. You only see the running of the coupling. And that's why strings can be quite easily described on this background. So far, it's kind of trivial, but still you see some signatures of the singularity also from the string perturbation theory. Namely, if you look at the string perturbation theory, the usual formulation. What I will do is indeed because of the geometry, it's sort of natural to choose a Lycon gauge. And let me just page up again. I mean, the background depends on x plus, and actually we're going to take x plus to be our Lycon time. So the background will be time dependent, and this is, however, not really visible in if you write down the world sheet action, because those are involve only the transversal coordinates, and the metric sort of looks the same in the transversal directions. But of course, the dependence is entirely contained in the string coupling, because it's a linear Dilaton background. So we can write it like this, and if I identify this x plus coordinate with the tau coordinate on the world sheet, I find it's just a tau dependent. But then you do perturbation theory, but then anything you do in the calculation on a perturbative level is just using the ordinary string action, so there's nothing changing much, except when you compute amplitudes or sum them up. You should, of course, multiply them with powers of the string coupling, but the string coupling depends on tau. So what you have to do is do the calculation of the scattering amplitudes and then multiply the whole thing with appropriate powers of tau. But you'll find actually that this is just factorizing, because you can do these calculations. The integrations, for example, over insertions of vertex operators, things like that, can be done independent. I mean, it doesn't really depend on where the tau is. It only has an overall tau dependence which can be integrated, and gives you a certain power of the string coupling, which is determined by the number of handles and number of insertions. And of course, the integral would diverge. If I would do it all the way from t equals minus infinity to plus infinity, I'll find a divergent answer, because the exponent, of course, will grow when this cutoff time goes to minus infinity. But anyhow, for any finite time, if I go to the future, I can do these calculations and find some sensible answers. But it breaks down when this time goes to minus infinity, and that should be the signal of a singularity there. So this is the perturbative string picture, but what I'm going to do is eventually formulate it in terms of a matrix description. But let me, before I do that, tell a little bit about sort of what it look like in a Lycon string field theory calculation, because Lycon string field theory has indeed the ordinary time tau sort of mapped out like this. And what you do in the usual formulation is you take world sheets that have this shape, where each string has a certain length that's a measure for the Lycon momentum that is carried by the string. And then if there are interactions, you cut sort of the world sheets in a certain way. So this is a point where the string joins, and this is where it has splits. And of course, if you take the coupling to be time-dependent, you sort of expect that this joining and splitting will become more dominant when the time at early time. So the world seeds that are relevant, they may look sort of like this, where you have a higher weight that you have to give to these interactions in the past. So another way of drawing this, I should say this way. I mean, one way in which you calculate this in string field theory is to insert operators that describe the joining and splitting, and these are actually twist fields. They're a way you can formulate, namely, the entire theory as sort of being defined on one world sheet, where what happens when you, and maybe I'll draw this, if you take two, this picture is useful to have in mind. If you take these strings, you can sort of think about them as being living on one world sheet, then you have two strings sort of that write like this. But when they join or when they split, what happens basically is that you have to take a double. I hope that's clear. This was two separate strings, but if you mix, twist, I mean, sort of exchange the two coordinates in one point, that's basically joining the string and making it twice as long, or sort of longer in this way. Well, this picture is actually how it can be made more precise by indeed writing down vertex operators that describe the joining and splitting, and it's a certain twist field. This is also the way that it's eventually going to appear from the matrix description. That's why I'm mentioning it. Another reason why I mentioned this is because, well, you see that the string coupling is time dependent, and it also is multiplying, of course, the interaction vertex. You could sort of say in the action I can add this interaction vertex times the string coupling. But since the string, this interaction vertex has a certain conformal dimension, you can actually do a conformal transformation that absorbs the time dependence purely in terms of the world sheet geometry. And then it looks like this, is where you write new world sheet coordinates, which are defined like this. You take psi plus and psi minus to be exponents of the world sheet time and coordinates, space coordinate. Then, of course, sigma is periodic, and that means that these psi plus minus will be identified up to a boost, sort of that becomes looks like a Milner space. And then what I gained, namely, is that at the point where the singularity is will now be at a finite position in the psi coordinates. And so the space, the world sheet sort of start to look like this. And there's a singularity in the past sort of where that's where psi equals zero. So you brought sort of the singularity into view. And then you can even describe this in a way that sort of, well, the time dependence is entirely contained in the geometry of the world sheet. Why do I mention this? Because this is indeed what we're going to do now. And what I'll do now is actually jump to my conclusion in a minute, of actually right now, and then explain how I arrived to it. So this is the description in perturbative string theory, but I'm going to give a different description now in terms of matrices. And I'm going to present that first, and then see how we get there. So the matrix description of this light-like dilaton background is a 1 plus 1 dimensional super Yang-Mills theory, and it's defined on a world sheet that looks like this. And if you write down Yang-Mills theory, it has a Yang-Mills coupling, but in the identification with the string, first of all, I should tell you this: all of these are n by n matrices, so it's an n by n of a un gauge theory, and of course there are an equal number as the number of coordinates. So I've replaced the eight coordinates of the transversal space-time by eight matrices. The un gauge theory is related to the light cone momentum of the string. And this can only be done if n is finite, if we work in what's called the discrete light cone quantization. So that means that the x minus coordinate must be taken to be periodic modulo some radius r. Eventually, of course, we want to take r to infinity. But then we also have to take n to infinity in such a way that these ratios are kept finite. Now this is just already the action of the usual matrix string theory. What I'll have to do now is actually indeed describe the time dependence that's in the string coupling. And the string coupling is related to the Yang-Mills coupling through this formula. Actually, the string coupling is inversely related to the Yang-Mills coupling. But you have to realize that the Yang-Mills coupling in two dimensions is dimension full. So I have to sort of make it dimensionless by including also the area of the world sheet metric. I mean, you know that, of course, string world sheet theory is usually conformal invariant, but if you add a gauge field, it's no longer conformal invariant, and in here you should indeed write square root of g's to make things, that does play a role. The action does depend on the determinants of the metric. But that's where the time dependence is, and so the action looks like this, but then I have to write g Yang-Mills in this time-dependent fashion. Now, another way of doing this is, of course, because of this relation, I can take G Yang-Mills to be constant and change the metric and make that time-dependent. Usually, that doesn't really do that much. If I rescale the metric by some function, you know that in string theory, as I said, it's conformal invariant. But because of these terms that are not conformally invariant, if I rescale the metric and make it time dependent, then this is only these are the only terms that are affected by it. So I can take a Yang-Mills coupling that is constant, but have a time dependent world sheet. And now again, you can do the same trick. We've seen it now a couple of times. Again, introduce this these coordinates, world sheet coordinates, psi plus and psi minus, and then you can see that this space is actually nothing but this Milner space. It has a flat, I mean, if you insert this in here, the metric becomes flat on the world sheet, but the non-trivial features are in the boundary conditions. I have to identify psi plus minus up to a boost. So this is the same kind of world sheet that I had in the string picture, and indeed, if you look at this theory now, it has two different descriptions, namely at early times, when tau goes to minus infinity, actually the string coupling, I should put them, I think I had a minus sign here, but okay. Did I do this? I think it is. I think I may have put this wrong sign here, because at early times I want the string coupling to be very large, and at late times to be very small, and the Yang-Mills coupling does the opposite. So I have, in early times, basically a free Yang-Mills theory, and indeed that will be described by matrices. And at late times, what will happen is that the Yang-Mills coupling will become large, or you might say the string coupling should become small, and then this potential term will dominate, and it will force the matrices to commute. And that's the way that space-time will emerge, because the eigenvalues that appear should describe the space-time coordinates. You look like you have a question. Yes.
Yeah, no. I'm getting puzzled. So you're talking about doing a sort of a light cone quantization or light cone
yes.
analysis, but now you have some null space. So do you sort of introduce null slicing of the cone?
Sorry, this is the world sheet.
That's the world.
So it's not the space-time. So the space-time was this singular geometry that I described, but the description of the string theory on that space-time is this theory on Milner space. And since the space-time coordinate, x plus coordinate, is identified with the world sheet coordinate, there's indeed a point on the world sheet where you hit the singularity. And that's the tip of this Milner cone. And so it's just a two-dimensional Milner space that's describing, I mean, and you put the Yang-Mills theory on that, that should be describing the space-time, is equivalent to the space-time description of this singularity.
In this description, the middle metric on the world sheet is just fixed.
It's fixed, so there's nothing fluctuating, there's no quantum gravity on the world sheet. I work in the light cone gauge, so there's no geometry I have to integrate over. And so the question of now is having to study what happens near the singularity just becomes studying what this Yang-Mills theory does in the neighborhood of this Milner cone. And that's not an easy question. I mean, there can be all kinds of things still wrong with that description, but it at least made it's tractable, because near the singularity, well, as I said, I mean, the Yang-Mills coupling goes to zero, so you even have free Yang-Mills theory in that. That's correct. That's right. Well, maybe the picture suggests something in the sense that, as I said, changing G Yang-Mills is also like changing the metric, and so you're basically squeezing your cylinder to become. No, I'm talking about a cylinder now. So it's just a cylinder, but then you can still make that cylinder have a small, tiny. I mean, you're basically reducing the size of the circle to zero, and that makes it into quantum mechanics. So you dimension. Oh. Well, this of course. Okay, so this is also, I think, related to how you do the limits. I think there must be ways in which the limits. Yeah, there must be a way in which that happens.
But on the Milner space, the Yang-Mills coupling is constant. It's not going to be zero.
That's right. So here, the Yang-Mills coupling is constant, and you're right. I mean, so but then it's still sort of a UV question you're asking about the gauge theory, and so the short distance behavior, since the Yang-Mills coupling is dimension full, effectively it becomes small. But I agree, this depends on how I scale my, well, momenta on the world sheet, some things like that. So there is, whether the Yang-Mills coupling is large or small depends also what the quanta would do in this area. Of course, if they would have very, I mean, that's also what makes the whole analysis somewhat complicated, is if you start, I mean, well, what would you like to do? Start from a certain state here and see what it sort of came from. Then you have to do some evolution in this theory. And I agree that at first you would sort of have to include all of the interaction terms that are there. There's one other point I should make here, and that's that the boundary conditions break the world sheet supersymmetry. Oh, sorry, even the space-time supersymmetry, because, and certainly on the world sheet, I mean, that's the important thing. Because, well, these boundary conditions are boosts now in this case, and that's not doesn't allow you to write down the supersymmetry transformations. So how does this work? I mean, the background was supersymmetric, was BPS, so it has half of the supersymmetry suspected. But if you write down a string that has a certain P plus momentum, it also respects half of the supersymmetries, but it appears that there it's a different half. I mean, it's precisely the complementary half that's being respected. So if you have indeed the time dependence as well as the string present, then together they break all of the supersymmetry. And the reason I say this is that what is usually making matrix theory work is that these matrices indeed commute, and there is a flat direction that gives us the origin of space. You want a space emerging from the flat directions in the potential, but they only remain flat because of the supersymmetry. They're protected by quantum effects from quantum effects if we have supersymmetry. So there's no supersymmetry when we have this boundary condition, and so in principle we could generate the potential. And at the end I'll indeed explain a calculation that was done by Ben Krabs, Safsetti, and Pacharaman, and they indeed have sort of verified that this picture will survive also if you include the potential. It's the world sheet supersymmetry that's broken here, which is irrelevant for this calculation. I think that is even true for the more general form. Anyhow, this description, I think, in terms of the Milner space and the boundary condition, I think is quite essential that we are working in the Lycone case. Otherwise, I'm not even sure how I should do this in the other situation. And as you know, of course, I mean, the matrix theory only can be formulated in that.
Sorry, that's the space-time supersymmetry and then corresponding to you to a constant shift of theta?
No, I think it's the other one.
It's the one which is preserved, sorry.
No, the
constant shift of theta give you like something trivial. It's
not so the constant shifts of theta, they are they're the Goldstone modes, and they are the ones that are broken by the string. No, the Goldstone modes are related to symmetries that are broken. So if you have a soliton, the soliton breaks half of the supersymmetry, then the zero modes of the coordinates on the world seat of the solitons are the broken symmetries.
Right.
And the world seat respects still some supersymmetry, namely that the part that's unbroken.
Right, but this part is precisely when we realize that the space-time geometry.
The shifts, you mean?
Yes.
That's right. So you're right. So the space-time supersymmetry, you can still build the space-time. So of course, and the background was half BPS. So I should still see those symmetries. But what I'm saying is because the world seed breaks those supersymmetries, that's why they are zero modes. There's no remaining world seed supersymmetry left anymore. And indeed, you can see this that because the boundary conditions will break it. And I think it has to do with the fact the way that the fermions have to transform under a transformation of this sort. I mean, you cannot make it work so that the fermions, anyhow, the supersymmetry.
The shift
is not enough, sorry. Anyhow, so the importance indeed is that there can be a potential generated. It has been calculated, indeed, one finds that the potential can appear.
And I'm sorry, one last question. The parameter n, is that fixed in terms of the original space-time background, or is it something new?
Oh, sorry. The n is related to the discrete light cone, so I have to... I will explain more. I mean, this is where I go back and explain the matrix description, of course, but that's a choice that comes in at some moment. But it's fixed, so it's not changing in the description, but it will depend on some compactification of the circle. Going a little bit sideways, I mean, not explaining it in linear order, here I explain how indeed the space-time sort of emerges. So when the coupling constant at late time goes to zero, you find that the matrices have to commute, and the way that then the light cone description, basically the light cone field theory description I had on board on this a while ago, appears quite naturally. Actually, precisely this picture of these winding strings sort of that comes about if you look at the eigenvalues of the commuting matrices. So that the matrices commute, you can all simultaneously diagonalize them, and you find that the boundary conditions commute a set of these, and in this way you sort of find that there are strings appearing, and the length of the string is the number of eigenvalues sort of that are commuted. And that's directly related to the indeed the P plus that's carried by this bit of the string. So you find indeed very nicely from this picture this light cone field theory framework, namely that indeed in this light cone field theory you have lengths of strings that are determined by the P plus momentum. But the total P plus of all of the strings together, that's what fixes n. So when you keep n fixed, you're basically looking in a sector of a given P plus carried by all the strings. But so the world sheet on which the Yang-Mills theory is defined is not the same as the world sheet of the string, I should say, because the strings, they, as I said, they wind around a number of times. So you should think about each string as being mapped onto this by, well, winding it many times, depending on how many P plus eigenvalues there are.
Well, just to be clear, so you're reconstructing space-time through these winding strings, but what? I mean, those are not very local. What about sort of momentum modes that you know, sort of localize?
Sorry, these are not, well, this is again, I mean, I think you're confusing the world sheet picture with the space-time picture. So this is the rule sheet.
When the axis commute, you want to reconstruct space-time, right? Or you're reconstructing the world sheet.
I'm reconstructing the world sheet with all of the coordinates, the usual space-time coordinates on the world sheet. So what we usually write down in string theory are strings moving in some space-time, and so indeed they have world sheet coordinates. And so I'm getting the world sheet coordinates out of these eigenvalues. And but these have then the meaning of the embedding of the string in space-time. But before I had this, I didn't know how to embed my sort of this theory. If it's just made out of matrices, you don't know where the string is living. I mean, there's not a picture even of the space-time, because from the world sheet you have only these matrices. It's only when they start commuting that the space-time picture becomes clear.
Okay, what becomes in the real?
That's correct, and so they are fluctuating a bit, and so indeed the space-time picture is more like matrices, but then only when they asymptotically start to commute you get it sort of back. But there must be a way in which the string coupling controls this sort of fuzziness.
Can we say that, you know, you have some bound fluctuations and the
radius that... Yes, I think you can, but well, I don't know it on the top of my head. So indeed, as I said, near the singularity, you mean you have this d equals to zero limit, and then you would have just matrices, and that has a very different picture.
That by itself, when you're living in a n-square dimensional target space.
That's true. No, not at all. So this is a, okay. You're actually right. I mean, there's no. All right. Now the potential what I'm gonna calculate is actually a potential for the diagonal elements if you start integrating out the off-diagonal ones. So the potential is being generated when I start from here and start integrating out off-diagonal components of the metric, and that's how the there will be a potential for the eigenvalues appearing. So it's a thing that will depend on the string coupling. So when it's completely free, you wouldn't see it. But anyhow, if you start integrating things out, you probably were not allowed to do it here anyway because they're massless. So it's only when you have a little bit of string coupling that you can, or of Yang-Mills coupling, so if the string coupling becomes finite, then you can do the integrations and you find some... Yes, I think so, yes.
Sorry, what is this
phi f then? Oh, it's just a trick. I mean, if I would send d Yang-Mills to zero here, I don't know how to do it. So I do the phi squared phi f, so you do the Gaussian integral, and then you put d Yang-Mills to zero. So you get a Lagrange multiplier basically putting f equal to zero.
But you have to then integrate
phi. Phi is a Lagrange multiplier that puts f equal to zero. So you basically couple to flat potential. I don't know. I mean, you're asking about the central charge question, whether that makes sense.
Yeah, I guess you're saying that the curve description you don't trust anyway here, but you just
that. But this is Lightcon gauge fixed, already gauge fixed.
Yeah, so in Lightcon gauge, there's no cancellation of ghosts versus, I mean, I think there's no issue about central charge.
Your world sheet here is not time dependent now.
I know this is just an observation about the action. I agree. This is something I. No, actually, I think the complete description is the one I have here with all the. I mean, I could. Okay, there are two ways in which I can describe this. One in the time dependent one. One is on the cylinder. If I take the cylinder with the time dependent Yang-Mills coupling, which was one of the choices I had, then in early times it would sort of look like this. This is basically. But then it would be propagating on a cylinder, where the singularity is really at t equals minus infinity. You're not really reaching the singularity using this theory. So this is also why I think studying how you propagate through the singularity is going to be hard, because you cannot really use this free description. So So this is basically the upshot. What I will do for the rest is basically derive the matrix string. I was asked sort of to do that. For those of you who are familiar with that, it's probably not the most interesting part, but for those who have not sort of followed that development, I can do it sort of some justice here. So what matrix theory started with is this well-known paper by Banks, Fischer, Schenker, and Susskind, and they proposed a action, a point particle matrix quantum mechanics action that looks like this. And the way they derived it, actually, or argued, came from thinking about D0 brains in 10 dimensions, and they had some clever argument why, well, first of all, D0 brain charge is the momentum in the 11th direction. And so then by doing some clever arguments, you can get to this description where the size of the matrix, as I mentioned before, is related to the P plus light cone momentum. So this is a description in a discrete light cone quantization again, where R is some arbitrary chosen radius, so you have to compactify this. And keeping R fixed and N fixed, of course, you get some description, but eventually, again, the same thing has to apply. You have to send N to infinity and R to infinity to get back the original, the full theory in without this compactified circle. So it's derived actually from a Born-Infeld action for D0 brains, which is a highly sort of nonlinear action. But in the limit, when you go sort of to the boosted frame where you compactify light cone direction, you can show that it sort of reduces down to this. And as I said, I mean, it makes use of this fundamental identification between the zero brain charge and 11D momentum.
Action makes a lot of space-time, right? The action doesn't make it into space-time,
it's matrices. You're right, but it's thought of being defined on a flat background. So you don't make, but it should describe sort of a non-perturbative description of the full M-theory. So even fluctuations and particular gravitons exchange, things like that, should be derived from this this matrix description.
So if you give that to some
value
student,
right,
they will not know anything about
DS11,
is that correct?
About this metric?
Yeah.
Well, it sort of appears there is some additional ingredients in defining in the theory. There are some, since I chose a light cone gauge, for example, I have to define what X minus and X plus are. X plus is again identified with the world sheet time. X minus is some constraint that you have to solve. So there are the usual things you have to add to get this the full. So there's some additional knowledge there. But then I agree with this action, you could do many things that sort of are independent of the space-time. It's just matrix quantum mechanics.
You want to have a large number of non-contact directions for this. So in your space you have in mind, just suspecting your dimensions.
This is of course the uncompactified theory, you know that, but the situation with which I looked at, the singularity theory where we had one compact circle. So that's why, but anyhow, to remind you of this, I mean, this is how we sort of obtained eventually also this matrix string theory, and some way of getting it is from this the BFSS action by indeed compactifying one additional coordinate y, and then thinking about the y matrix as being a derivative on the world sheet. Because if n is very large, and you get what you basically get if you compactify this, then you have to imagine that this is describing a lot of D0 brains. You have to sort of group them in images, because you get images when you would do this identification. So the matrices have to be indeed taken to infinity and very large, and then the y can formally be written then as a derivative. I'm not going to go through the details of that, but you should sort of feel intuitively that a non-commuting matrix and a derivative have sort of similar properties. And indeed, the trace also then becomes a integral over the corresponding coordinate. In a certain way, this is like this was a discretization of this quite similar base actually to this kind of discretizations that happens in loop quantum gravity. Anyhow, the matrix string action then appears just from this by making these substitutions. And the identification of the Yang-Mills coupling constant with G-string also would appear quite naturally. It must be related to the 11th circle. I'm not going to explain how that goes in detail, but the basically you should think about also this circle, the R11, as the size of this cylinder on which I defined the two-dimensional Yang-Mills, because as you see, the y-coordinate becomes basically the derivative, so there's an inverse relation between the size of the circle and the R11.
I mean, in a place where G Yang-Mills is constant, you could redefine tilts and put the one over G Yang-Mills out in front of the whole action.
That's true.
Things vary with tau, they're not the same thing. Is this the right thing to do, is to not rescale, not to put one over G Yang-Mills in front of the action?
Yeah, okay, so what I will show next, indeed, is if I would take the M theory background and put it in your action in the appropriate places, that going through these steps, that this is the right way that it, so.
But it doesn't matter, because it doesn't matter, you can rescale in the front, but with the time-dependent metric, you can do something there.
I'm sorry?
I mean, there's a way in which you can put every...
In the front, it doesn't matter, because it just looks like you have time-dependent metric.
Yeah, but then the action, when you get like a map, kind of in a master and stuff. You know, like if you
would put
time derivative hitting the time dependent coupling. So it actually, yeah.
I mean, doing the rescalings that one usually does, if you would sort of put
right,
it out of, yeah.
So
there might be things appearing in here, you mean, because of the that I could, that quite, yeah, that's right.
So it matters what's the right thing to do.
Yeah, that's right. Actually, for other backgrounds, indeed, such things like that have to be also done quite carefully, and you do find then others, indeed, the kind of mass terms you're talking about. Anyhow, the idea we had to get to this matrix string came from the following sort of diagram. So I told you that the zero brain number is sort of related to the 11th dimensional momentum. But if you think about still the 2A theory with the zero brains, then if you do a T duality along an additional circle, so you take a ninth circle to be compact, then this becomes the one winding number. Then an S duality gives this, changes the D string with the fundamental string, so then it becomes winding number for the fundamental string. And then another T duality along this compact circle gives this to be a momentum in the nine direction. And it's this momentum in the nine direction that's going to be boosted and become the discrete light cone P plus momentum. And so you see that the P plus momentum and the D zero brain quantum mechanics were directly related through this duality chain. But what's more is that in this, if you have a compact circle, then that circle can be chosen to be the 11th direction, or thought of as being the 11th direction. And then you're back in string theory, but you find that the string description then can be taken to be this D1 brain, and that's exactly what sort of derivation of this sort would show you, is that you can use the D1 world volume theory to derive the matrix string action as well. So you don't need to use actually the zero brains, you can start from D1s right from the beginning. I mean, the step to replace the Y by the derivative is basically already appearing in this kind of T-duality. There we usually do the same thing, because we also know that then the world sheets of D-brains get an additional dimension. There was a precise derivation of Seiberg that made it sort of all hang together, namely if you, instead of taking the discrete light cone strictly with the R in the light direction, you sort of choose one auxiliary sort of coordinate that you also shift by a small amount, and then you have this parameter epsilon that you want to send to zero. And a nice thing now is that the circle that's being formed this way is just space-like. You can make a Lorentz transformation that looks like this, that makes the identification purely in this form. And then you can show that if you take the epsilon to zero limit, indeed the metric sort of becomes quite simple, and also well, if you would do the derivation with the t-duality, you find there's a t-dual circle that actually blows up and becomes decompactified, and very nicely the p plus momentum sector with n, labeled by n, becomes mapped onto a description in terms of d1 branches, nd1 branches stretched out in this x tilde direction. So this is a derivation that sort of works quite nicely, and what it mainly shows, and that's where we should give credit to Seiberg for, is that he indeed showed indeed that the string oscillators and also the gravity decouples in this limit, and therefore he sort of, we know that that the theory is sort of complete, and we haven't sort of overlooked things or left some things out. This you can now do also for these time-dependent backgrounds. That's basically the last part of my talk. It's going to be about how to get see indeed that the derivation that I gave or the action I wrote down was the correct one. So if you do this in the curved background, you write this action, you have to generalize it, and you find that it sort of appears in certain places. Basically, how does this work? Yeah, you have to think about the time derivative in terms of indeed the x plus being identified with x plus. You have to sort of figure out where all of these powers go, and it very nicely sort of puts it only in terms of, in front of the terms that I had in the beginning. Namely, these terms will all cancel. There are no derivative, no powers in front. It's only in these terms that's going to be identified with the Yang-Mills coupling.
Just remind, Q is a three-parameter order one.
Q is actually a redundant parameter because you cannot you can rescale x plus by boost. So it's a null direction. So I can always.
So the answer should be independent.
The answer is independent of Q, except of course putting it to zero would be a singular limit.
And can you see that that the answer is independent of Q?
In this setup, that I can rescale Q. It's probably rescaling tau by some bit, and.
But that depends on them not having a characteristic energy scale.
I agree. Once you have something in space-time that it starts moving and has a certain momentum, you could sort of form an invariant out of Q and that object. So I think in a certain way, the physics may depend on those invariants. You could hit the sort of the linear dilaton background with a certain wave, and then you see.
Right, so it would be independent of the level of plasma geometry, relatively the quantum geometry, but Q compared to the Planck scale or something.
Of any probe that sort of moves in this background will see it. I mean, it would see the gradient of the dilaton. So that's also why how it affects probably the amplitudes. I mean, the loop amplitudes. Okay, so we do again the same trick, and you get precisely to this description I had before. Actually, this is just a copy of the same transparency, except now I've written it in terms of the G-string coordinate, and with these identifications, you get to the same conclusions. So basically, I'm at the end of my talk, because I already told you this bit. Is that this is sort of the final description of what singularity looks like. And so the next thing that I needed to do was sort of tell a little bit about what happens after this work that we did quite a while ago. I mean, I must admit I had to read quite a bit of it this week still. But
is it clear that the prescription you write down, this matrix quantum mechanics for the 11 dimension, actually is the right thing to do, because as you said in the BFSS story, they need to do some very clever arguments, say this pattern stuff to really say that's the right action.
Yeah, this is actually one of my collaborators certainly went through the whole Seiberg argument and with this background and verified that all the steps using that as well. So that's sort of an independent derivation of the same thing. I mean, here I indeed sort of made the thing look sort of simple by saying, well, all I need to do is take this action and put in this, but you have to go through that argument to indeed show that that's the correct way to do it. I mean, I thought that was your question or not?
I'm just asking, how do you know that Seiberg's argument actually applies to this case?
Yeah, okay, so there are various skills that are involved once you start doing these limits, because in Seiberg's theory you also had to separate, make sure that all these skills are separated. As I said, I mean, you can read it in our paper. I'm not able to sort of reproduce the whole argument right here. Actually, I have the slide somewhere, but I left it out from here. Now, what I want to end up with is just indeed the discussion of the potential that's being generated. I already told you about this fact that the boundary condition is breaks the world sheet supersymmetry. So if you look at the conclusions, which these are the same which I had actually in my talk at Strings in Toronto, but anyhow, I didn't want to change them so much, because anyhow, the one of the things that I had already we already sort of expected then was that indeed the potential can be generated, and that's one of the things that has been calculated afterwards by the people I already mentioned. Well, that what's the other points I made indeed is that we haven't really sort of been able to convincingly argue that you can really propagate through the Milner singularity. So I wouldn't call this a resolution of the singularity, but we do have quite a controlled description of what's happening near the singularity. Oh yes, there are some generalizations that people have been discussing, and well, there are some solvable backgrounds that you can write down. And one of the calculations that was done by people in Chicago was indeed for this null brain that I mentioned in the beginning. They also have a similar sort of matrix description, and found indeed also there that when you get to the near the singularity, the theory becomes dominated by a matrix, sort of a gluon phase, and the space-time again loses its meaning. So there's sort of the same kind of phenomena that happens in here. And as a final comment, Anita, I want to show this potential that was generated. This is the formula I got from their paper. So if you take the matrices, if you start commuting them, you have their eigenvalues, but the eigenvalues, you want to have them moving along the potential in flat direction. So you can generate a potential as a function of, calculate it as a function of B being the separation between the eigenvalues, and they show that the answer looks like this. It's a very nice formula, I find, but and indeed what is relevant for the whole discussion is that near the Big Bang, sort of the singularity, when G string is large, this potential does play a role. So you do find indeed some way in which the, but of course the what you really want to show is that when the matrices start to commute, that they are the eigenvalues can separate and that space and time can form. So indeed, fortunately, when G string goes to zero, you can check of course that this will go to zero as well, and so at late times the potential should not be so important, and we get back space time. It's a one-loop calculation. So what they basically did is you take the diagonal matrix and you integrate out the off-diagonal components, and you have to do this on the Milner space. So there's a little bit of trickery to calculate the determinants on Milner space. They write down the Green's function at the right condition, and from that you have sort of a heat kernel way of calculating the potential, the one-loop answer. So the you're right, but the that's right. Getting more supersymmetric, and intuitively it's also clear. The boundary conditions break the supersymmetry, but as soon as it starts expanding, you sort of notice less of the boundary if the thing is big. I mean, it's really just broken by boundary conditions, so the thing should depend only on sort of the rough scale, and at large late times you don't see it anymore. Yes.
Separations of the eigenvalues and it breaks down when they get very close together.
Yeah, I have to put in a certain scale for this in order for this calculation to sort of be reliable. I forgot again what they did, but they have some range of parameters that you should put in. All right, that's it.
you to say anything about what the data found. But yeah, can you make some statement regarding what happens at the similarity?
Yeah, only trivial ones, sort of, in the sense I can sort of make things symmetric, or I don't know. I mean, there's you have to put in some boundary condition on how to propagate fields through there. But
I thought they have a free theory. But the main difficulty is because of you don't know the potential, but what could be generated, the potential generated there.
Now, for me, it's also the geometry of the Milner space, the singularity that appears there, that I don't know. Also, the questions that Eva asked is whether the momenta that are relevant there, whether they are so large that still the interactions do play a role. But also field theory, if you look at the behavior of Green's functions, things like that, you might see that there are certain singular things still happening at the tip. And so that's one of the calculations that, I mean, I've been discussing this with my collaborators, of course, but I think for a long time, Ben Krups was basically convincing me that there were all kinds of things divergent about field theory, even on a Milner space. Although they did it, so, I mean, he sort of took calculations they did in some higher dimensions. So in two dimensions, things are somewhat maybe better. But anyhow, no one did the calculation, and so there's still a question for me there that I don't know yet.
Isn't it also true that in the frame where the Angmos coupling is really going to zero, the cylinder is infinite?
That's right.
And the singular is really off infinity.
That's right.
So you can't just get to zero coupling by that time.
That's right, yeah.
And then there's other things that's more complicated.
That's right. No, that's precisely. I mean, so yeah, it would have been easier if in on the cylinder we would have hit the singularity in a finite time. That, yeah.
So therefore, I mean, it could be that in fact there is some ambiguity propagation. We don't know yet.
Yeah. I think there could be an ambiguity there in the propagation, or there are certain boundary conditions that are required there.
Just some live question, just to compare with, you know, kind of things that happen in Lucan gravity with the singularity. So here, when it's a big bang, it really is this null singularity.
That's right, it's sort of big bang in.
The second thing is that, well, in Lucan gravity, we could sort of see where, you know, classical relativity breaks down. So can one see, for example, here, that in the space time picture, where you say that the one, so that in fact, space-time description fails to vary, then Riemann curvature reaches either string scale or Planck scale or something.
Okay.
But now this fluctuation is difficult because it's not only matrices are becoming.
I mean, yeah, whether you can relate the sort of fuzziness that you get from the matrices to anything happening in space-time, yeah. It's an interesting question. I haven't thought about it, but it's something one should be able to do. Actually, yeah.
All your curvature invariants are zero for this moment.
That's actually precisely what I wanted to get to, is that...
In some sense, those components get written down because of the future of which we have blown up because of the...
They can, but to give them a scale may be difficult.
Yeah.
Well, you could have a parallelly propagated frame.
Yeah, but if you
lose
that, I think
you need some sort of frame.
You need to pick a frame to choose.
Yeah, but you can pick a frame, you know, out in the region where, you know, curvatures are not big, and then just go ahead and parallelly propagate it.
But if you boost it, it will rescale all the answers. So I think
right. So if you have some, you know, enormous boost, you can make something that's small and big. But that always happens. So to what extent can the sort of methods you're using here be generalized either to the case of a space-time singularity that is space-like rather than null, or to a space-time singularity that's null but not plane symmetric?
Good question. I mean, I don't know. I mean, this is, for me, it was certainly a very easy example because of the sort of trivial way we started from a linear dilaton background. As I said, in the meantime, some people have generalized this to some other singularities, but I think they're all of the kind which are null with the kind of symmetries you're talking about. So I think that's still quite an important open question, and I'm not even sure whether the picture will be sort of similar in those situations.